Today, I would like to share some lessons that I learned during my recent trip to Rome. And there were three of them. First, the times they are a-changin'. Second, wells make us well. And third, nothing is impossible with God. Let's begin with number one, the times they are a-changin'. When I was in Rome, I visited the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls, the place where Paul, the Apostle Paul, is purportedly buried. His tombstone reads in Latin, Paulo Apostolo Mart, the Apostle Paul, a martyr. As I looked into the tomb of this first century Messianic Jew, I thought of how surprised Paul would be to see how he is depicted in countless books, commentaries, and sermons. How shocked he would be to find out that most 21st century Christians think of Paul as having abandoned Judaism to embrace a new religion called Christianity, and as having taught that the church replaced the Jewish people as the people of God. How shocked Paul would be to see this distorted, de-Judaized image of who he was and what he taught. And yet, Paul was deeply aware of the fact that the body of Messiah, even in his own day, was rife with imperfection. Did this result in Paul giving up on being actively involved in a local congregation? Did he abandon the body of believers because of its imperfections and say, I don't need them. I don't need institutional religion to walk with the Lord. Life with God is a relationship, not a religion. Did Paul say that? On the contrary, Paul became all the more committed to the Messianic Jewish movement of his day because of its imperfections. Let me say that again. On the contrary, Paul became all the more committed to the Messianic Jewish movement of his day because of its imperfections. He actively contributed to making it stronger and had a vision for it growing to maturity. He writes in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 14, it was he, the Messiah, who gave some to be emissaries, some to be prophets, some to be sharers of the good news, and some to be shepherds and teachers, to prepare God's people for works of service, so that the body of Messiah may be built up until we all reach, and then what does it say? Unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God, and become, what? Mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Messiah. Then we will no longer be infants, tossed back and forth by the waves and blown here and there by every wind of teaching. When Paul says, then we will no longer be infants, he is implying that in the day in which he lived, many of the people in his congregations were like infants. They knew very little about the Word of God or life with God. They were impressionable and easily influenced by people who promoted misunderstandings of the Scriptures, what Paul calls every wind of teaching. Even in Paul's own day, his own teachings were misunderstood. Peter writes in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 15 through 16, bear in mind that our Lord's patience means salvation, just as our dear brother Paul also wrote you with the wisdom that God gave him. He writes the same way in all his letters, speaking in them of these matters. His letters contain some things that are hard to understand, which ignorant and unstable people distort as they do the other scriptures to their own destruction. Luke tells us in the book of Acts that when Paul returned to Jerusalem prior to his arrest, that there were many rumors circulating in the holy city that Paul was teaching Jews to no longer keep the Torah. We are told in Acts chapter 1, verses 17 through 22, when we arrived in Jerusalem, When we arrived in Jerusalem, the brothers received us warmly. The next day, Paul and the rest of us went to see Yaakov, and all the elders were present. Paul greeted them and reported in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they heard this, they praised God. Then they said to Paul, "You see, brother, how many thousands of Jews have believed, and all of them are zealous for the law. They have been informed that you teach all the Jews who live among the Gentiles to turn away from Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or live according to our customs. What shall we do?" Paul goes on to prove to the congregation in Jerusalem that the rumors about him were false. My point is that Paul, the one whose tomb I was gazing into, perfectly understood that the body of Messiah was imperfect, profoundly imperfect, that even his own life and teachings were massively misunderstood. In response, he did not, in immaturity, abandon the messianic Jewish community of his day. On the contrary, he longed for and knew a day would come when these misunderstandings would be corrected, a day when Yeshua followers would no longer be infants, but would grow to maturity and a unity in the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God, Yeshua the Messiah. He knew a day would come when gifted teachers in the body of Messiah would steer people away from every wind of teaching and toward a reading of the Holy Scriptures, including his own letters, that reflected maturity and unity in the messianic Jewish faith. Perhaps we are even today living in a time in history when many of these misunderstandings are starting to be corrected. In 1964, exactly 50 years ago, Bob Dylan wrote a song entitled, "The Times, They Are a-Changin'." About 15 years after Bob Dylan wrote this song, Dylan, who is Jewish, became a follower of Yeshua, the Messiah of Israel. I remember as a teenager listening to Dylan's 1979 album, Slow Train Coming, and his 1980 album entitled Saved. In Slow Train Coming, Dylan opens with the song, "Gotta Serve Somebody," which really impacted me as a young person. Would you like to hear this song? Can the media play this song? All right, let's hear it.
To England or France, you may like to gamble, you might like to dance, you may be the heavyweight champion of the world, you may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict prancing on the stage, money, drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
It may be a state trooper. It may be a young Turk. Maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
In response to Dylan's hit song, Gotta Serve Somebody, John Lennon wrote and recorded the song, Serve Yourself, which was intended to mock Dylan's faith in Yeshua. This is all background for my point that Dylan, 50 years ago, said, the times, they are a-changin', with respect to social upheaval in the world around him. Similarly, I would say in 2014 that the times, they are a-changin' with respect to theological upheaval in the world of New Testament studies, and most recently in the area of Pauline scholarship. As many of you know, about a week and a half ago, I went to the third Nangeroni meeting in Rome that was sponsored by the University of Michigan on the subject of rereading Paul as a Second Temple Jewish author. 37 scholars came to this conference who specialized in New Testament and Second Temple Judaism. And I was invited to give a major paper on Romans 14. We all stayed at the same hotel, spent 5 days together, 8 hours a day, listening to papers and discussing them, eating breakfast and lunch together, and sometimes dinner and gelato together. As part of the conference, we traveled to Ostia Antica to see the archaeological remains of this harbor city with its 5th-century synagogue. And Daniel Boyarin, who came with his wife Chava, gave a lecture at the Gregoriana, the Pontifical Gregorian University, on the subject of Paul the Jew. The scholars at the conference included, among others, Paula Fredrickson, Gabriella Boccaccini, William Campbell, Kathy Ehrensberger, Pam Eisenbaum, Mark Nanos, Caroline Johnson Hodge, Isaac Oliver, Carlos Segovia, and Magnus Zetterholm. These scholars are all arguing for a new reading of Paul's writings. What we call a messianic Jewish perspective at Tikvat Israel, they call the radical new perspective, or reading Paul within Judaism. As an example, I would like to share a few excerpts from Gabriella Boccaccini's paper. Professor Boccaccini is a professor of Second Temple Judaism and early rabbinic literature at the University of Michigan, and he is regarded as a senior scholar in these fields. He writes in the introduction to his paper, quote, "A new paradigm is emerging today with the radical new perspective, a paradigm that aims to fully rediscover the Jewishness of Paul. Paradoxically, Paul was not a Christian, since Christianity at the time of Paul was nothing else than a Jewish messianic movement. And therefore, Paul should be regarded as nothing other than a Second Temple Jew. What else should he have been? Paul was born a Jew, of Jewish parents, was circumcised, and nothing in his work supports or even suggests the idea that he became or regarded himself as an apostate. On the contrary, Paul was a member of the early Jesus movement, and with strength and unmistakable clarity, proudly claimed his Jewishness and declared that God also did not reject God's covenant with the chosen people. He writes in Romans 11, "Has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin." Boccaccini goes on to say, "The goal of my paper is to fully embrace the paradigm of the radical new perspective, not as the conclusion, but as the starting point of our conversation at the third Nangeroni meeting in Rome. In my opinion, the potential of such an approach has just begun to manifest. We have still a long way to go before fully understanding all its monumental implications. In order to properly locate Paul the Jew in the context of the diverse world of Second Temple Judaism, we need first of all to establish a better communication between New Testament scholars and Second Temple specialists, two fields of studies that to date have remained too distant and deaf to each other. This is what our meeting is about. This is the future of Pauline studies." Boccaccini goes on to offer three caveats about the Jewishness of Paul. They are as follows. Quote, A, in order to reclaim the Jewishness of Paul, we do not have to prove that he was a Jew as everybody else, or that he was not an original thinker. It is important not to apply to Paul a different standard than to any other Jew of his time. To claim that finding any idea in Paul that is unparalleled in other Jewish authors makes Paul non-Jewish would lead to the paradox that no original thinker of Second Temple Judaism should be considered Jewish. Certainly not Philo or Josephus or Hillel or the teacher of righteousness, all of whom also formulated original answers to the common questions of their age. Why should only Paul be considered non-Jewish or no longer Jewish simply because he developed original thinking? The very notion of making a distinction within Paul between his Jewish and non-Jewish or quote-unquote Christian ideas does not make any sense. Paul was Jewish in his traditional ideas and remained such even in his originality. Paul was a Jewish thinker, and all his ideas, even the most nonconformist, were Jewish. He then has B. In order to reclaim the Jewishness of Paul, we do not have to downplay the fact that he was a very controversial figure, not only within Second Temple Judaism, but also within the early Jesus movement. The classical interpretation that the controversial nature of Paul, both within and outside his movement, relied on his attempt to separate Christianity from Judaism, does not take into consideration the diversity of Second Temple Jewish thought. There never was a monolithic Judaism versus an equally monolithic Christianity. There were many diverse varieties of Judaism, including the early Jesus movement, which in turn was also very diverse in its internal components. And the third caveat that Boccaccini gives, C, is that, quote, in order to reclaim the Jewishness of Paul, we do not have to prove that he had nothing to say to Jews, and that his mission was only aimed to the inclusion of Gentiles. As Daniel Boyarin has reminded us in his work on Paul, a Jew is a Jew and remains a Jew, even when he or she expresses radical self-criticism toward his or her own religious tradition or against other competitive forms of Judaism. Limiting the entire Pauline theological discourse to the sole issue of the inclusion of Gentiles would once again confine Paul the Jew at the fringes of Judaism and overshadow the many implications of his theology in the broader context of Second Temple Jewish thought. Boccaccini then goes on to write on the subject of Paul the convert, and he says, quote, "As in the case of Jesus, the problem of Paul is not whether he was a Jew or not, but what kind of Jew he was. Because in the diverse world of Second Temple Judaism, there were many different ways of being a Jew. According to his own words, Paul was educated as a Pharisee. The idea that he abandoned Judaism when he, quote-unquote, converted into the Jesus movement is simply anachronistic. Conversion as an experience of radical abandonment of one's religious and ethical identity was indeed known in antiquity, as attested in Joseph and Asenath and in the works of Philo. But this was not the experience of Paul. Christianity at his time was a Jewish messianic movement." By the way, Boccaccini says Jewish messianic movement. What do we say? Messianic Jewish movement. So you see, they're even using our terms. They're just kind of switching them around a little. Not a separate religion. Paul, who was born and raised a Jew, remained such after his quote-unquote conversion. Nothing changed in his religious and ethical identity. What changed, however, was his view of Judaism. In describing his experience not as a prophetic call, but as a heavenly revelation, Paul himself indicated the radicality of the event. Paul did not abandon Judaism, but quote-unquote converted from one variety of Judaism to another. With Alan Siegel, I would agree that Paul was a Pharisaic Jew who converted to a new apocalyptic Jewish sect. And Boccaccini then says, "In no way we should downplay the relevance of the event. It was a move within Judaism, and yet a radical move that reoriented Paul's entire life and worldview. If today a Reform rabbi became an ultra-Orthodox Jew, or vice versa, we also would describe such an experience in terms of quote-unquote conversion. Likewise, Paul's quote-unquote conversion should be understood not as a chapter in the parting of the ways between Christianity and Judaism, but as an occurrence in the context of the diversity of Second Temple Judaism," unquote. These excerpts from Professor Boccaccini's paper are just a few examples among the many papers presented at this conference that argued for a similar reading of Paul. Isn't this exciting? It's not just our community that's seeing this about Paul. It's a growing way of thinking within the world of New Testament studies and within the world of the study of Second Temple Judaism. We are living in extraordinary times to see work like this being presented at the highest levels of New Testament scholarship. These papers from the third Nangeroni meeting on rereading Paul as a Second Temple Jewish author, including my own paper on Paul and the food laws in Romans 14, verses 14 and 20, will be published in a forthcoming volume, probably in 2015. The times, they are a-changin'. And this brings us to a second lesson that I learned on my trip. Wells make us well. We are told in John chapter 4, verses 5 through 6, Yeshua came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Yeshua, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. Here we find Yeshua sitting down by a well. Why? Because it was a place of physical refreshment. We all need to find our own wells to get refreshed. When I planned the trip to Rome, I tagged on a couple of vacation days before and after the conference so I could take a break and get re-energized. And I want to say Rome was the perfect place to do this. The people in Rome are just so laid back. Italians know how to relax. and enjoy life. I felt surrounded by good food, beauty, and most of all, happy, generous, and fun-loving people. As long as you're not driving in Rome, stress disappears into the atmosphere. It was the perfect place to have a few days of vacation. And in coming back, I feel refreshed and strengthened. This summer, I want to encourage all of us to take a break and get refreshed. Tired from his long journey, Yeshua sat down by a well. Have you had a long journey this year? Are you stressed out and in need of a break? My advice is this: follow Yeshua's example. Find a well, get well, and refreshed. And this brings us to a third lesson that I learned on my trip in Rome, and that is, nothing is impossible with God. The trip to Rome was 10 days long, so I packed a lot of clothes in a big suitcase. I arrived at the airport, the Richmond airport, on time, checked in, went through security, and then found out that my flight was delayed 2 hours because of the lightning storms in Chicago. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this is also for the best. Because of the delay, I missed my flight in Chicago, which was a direct flight to Rome. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this is also for the best. They rebooked me on a flight that went to London, but I missed the London to Rome connection. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. When I finally arrived in Rome, I went to the baggage claim area, and I waited for my suitcase, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, but it never came out of that little machine. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. I went to the lost luggage counter at British Air and filled out a form describing the suitcase and giving them my contact information. They told me that the luggage would probably arrive later that night and they would deliver it to the hotel the next morning. So I went to the hotel, went to sleep, got up in the morning, put on the only clothes I had, which I had been wearing, and said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. I called British Air. I went out, enjoyed the day, came back, but there was no luggage. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. I called British Air, and they said that they had not found the luggage, yet, at least, but that they would send it along as soon as they found it. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. The second day, the luggage didn't arrive either. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. The third day, the luggage didn't arrive. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. The fourth day passed, the fifth day, the sixth day, the seventh day, the eighth day, the ninth day, and still no luggage. So I said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. Finally, the day came for me to return to the United States. I arrived at the airport, checked in, and then went to the British Air lost and found. Many people had told me that I would never see my luggage again. But I remembered the angel's words to Miriam, the mother of Yeshua, in Luke chapter 1, verse 37. Ki lo yipale me Elohim kol davar. For nothing is impossible with God. At the British Air lost and found desk, they also said that it was unlikely I would find the luggage since it had been 10 days. But I insisted, and they allowed me to go into a place that few eyes have ever seen. The land of lost luggage. I went into a very large room. that was filled with suitcases from floor to ceiling, from wall to wall. In addition to this room, I was told that there were two warehouses filled with lost luggage if it was not here. I said to myself, for nothing is impossible with God. I randomly took three steps in front of me and immediately saw my luggage right in front of my eyes. It was like seeing an old friend. I was so happy. The suitcase was in perfect condition, unopened, and all the tags were still on it. Why British Air couldn't find my luggage that was right next to their office with all my information on it is still a mystery to me. But since I prayed about it and put it in God's hands and said, Gamzu Letova, this must also be for the best. Somehow, it must have also been for the best. And because I recovered the luggage before returning home, I say, Baruch Hashem, nothing is impossible with God. Let's all say that together with all of our hearts. Nothing is impossible with God. Today we have talked about lessons from Rome, and I had 3 points. First, the times, they are a-changing. The things that we have seen in our little movement, the Messianic Jewish community, the Lord is now showing to scholars in the fields of New Testament and Second Temple Judaism. And you know what? I think even though we can't connect all the dots, that there is a connection between the existence of our community and this happening now in the highest levels of New Testament scholarship. Second, wells make us well. I encourage that all of us to take some time this summer. Find a place where the people are relaxing to be with and just enjoy. Take a break. Get refreshed like Yeshua did. And finally, nothing is impossible with God. Let's pray.